Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another edition of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. We're going to be keeping it in the Great White North again. We're going back to Canada. This week, I'm going to be bringing you a conversation with Neil604, the Canadian atheist. You can catch him on YouTube. That's kind of his primary platform. If you do a search on YouTube for Neil604 atheist, you will find his channel. Primarily, he deals with deconversion stories, and this is something I really wanted to talk to Neil about in this episode today. We go into a little bit of his own backstory, and then I get into the issue of why he started his YouTube channel. Why is he so interested in talking to people who have deconverted, as it were, or we can call it spiritual transitions or divorcing religion? And in fact, speaking of divorcing religion, one of my former guests, Jana Selby, who's also from Canada, she was on Neil's show a while back, so you can go into his archives and check out her episode. Now, speaking of Janice, she's going to be offering another Divorcing Religion workshop coming up very soon here. If you contact me, I can put you in touch with Janice. If you support Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, there's a way to get a 30% discount for this great second workshop that Janice is now running. And in fact, I've heard from people who have taken her first workshop, and they have said that it was fantastic, super helpful. So if you are one of these people that Neil talks to, one of the people who are, you know, walking away from religion, who are divorcing religion, as it were, it does feel like a divorce in many ways. There's a loss of a tremendous amount of investment. We've invested years of our lives in many cases. I know I did. I went to Bible college. I went to seminary. I put in a huge amount of effort and time getting degrees in preparation for ministry. Then I spent years and years as a pastor. And then I did my PhD. We moved over here to the UK. Oh, it was about 13 years ago now. I did my PhD. And then I went into teaching. I taught at a Bible college for the next 8 years or so. I taught Bible, theology, missional leadership, all those kind of things. So I have invested basically my entire adult life into either preparing for ministry or being in ministry. So walking away from that, it's basically the loss of all of that investment, time, money, effort, energy, all the relationships that go along with that. So if that sounds like sort of your experiences, you've lost that social network, as it were, the community that you had as part of the church or whatever religion it is that you've left behind, then you'll understand. And this is something that Janice is really good at helping people do. Now, before we get into the conversation with Neil, I wanted to say a couple of thank yous. You may have noticed there's a new introduction tune, a new great riff at the beginning of this podcast. And for that, I want to give a big shout out to John Amor. Or I guess it could be pronounced John Amor, I'm not sure. But either way, I want to give John a huge thank you for providing me with a great intro riff for this show. And if you want to look him up, he spells his name J-O-N-A-M-O-R. You can look him up on johnamor.com. That's a great riff from his song, 24 Hours. I wanted to rock it up a little bit because I'm into rock and blues and all that. Now, I've seen John a few times at some of his gigs over here in Chester, which is not far from where I live now in North Wales. In fact, he's coming up again in, I think, October. So I'm looking forward to going and catching his band again. But take a look at johnamor.com if you want to check out some of his music. It's kind of bluesy rock, really good stuff. So thanks to John for hooking me up with some great music. And then speaking of thank yous, I wanted to give a thank you to Michelle Oney Snyder. She is our latest Patreon supporter. So thank you, Michelle, for being a great supporter of Mindshift Podcast. I wanted to also thank Craig Alvin. You may have noticed, hopefully, that the audio quality of this podcast has gotten better. And we have Craig to thank for that. He popped up a couple of weeks ago on Facebook and said he had some tips for helping me improve the audio quality of the podcast. So I'm working through some things that make the quality sound better. In fact, I sent him the file for this conversation with me and Neil, and he helped clean it up and do some things to it. So hopefully the audio is better there too. Now, coming up next week, we're going to see if that's the case, because I've got an interview with Ronna Russell. She is the author of a brand new book that's just come out called The Uncomfortable Confessions of a Preacher's Kid. We had a fantastic conversation, and I hope the audio quality is a lot better for that, because Craig showed me some tips on how to record directly via Skype instead of doing it like I used to do it. So thanks again to Craig Alvin for hooking me up with some great tips and advice on how to improve the audio quality of this show. All right, so let's go on into it. I want to bring you now this conversation with Neil 604, the atheist from Canada. We're going to get into deconversion stories, and maybe you'll find yourself in Neil's story as well, or at least our interaction will be helpful for you if you're on this path of reconstruction, moving beyond just deconstructing whatever religious background you came out of. There's a lot of baggage, hurt, grief, pain, loss, social networks, and all kinds of things that we have to work through. So looking at deconversion stories makes us realize that we're not the only ones out there, that we're part of an ever-growing community, really. So I'm glad to be talking with Neil. So let's get into deconversion stories with Neil 604. I'm so happy to be joined by Neil 604, the atheist. Now, you were telling me what the 604 refers to. Can you tell the listeners what is the 604 again?
Yeah, well, Neil, the 604 atheist. The 604 itself is representative of the area code for where I live, which is Vancouver, British Columbia, Lower Mainland area.
Right.
It's so, the original area code pretty much for all of BC until they decided to split the area codes. Now they have 604, which is merely the Lower Mainland. And now it's 250 for anything outside of the Lower Mainland. And there's some other ones, too, like for different cell numbers and stuff, like 778, et cetera. So there's a bunch now.
So you,
but 604 is the original. And that's when I was born, that was the only one that was available at the time. So
that's you, Neil, 604. You're not the first Canadian I've had on this show, but for some reason, I mean, I don't know if you've met David Hayward, the Naked Pastor, but he was just on the show recently. He's been on a couple times. You had Janice Selby, who's the wise counselor on Twitter. That's her Twitter handle. And I know she was just recently on your YouTube channel just a few weeks ago. People can look that up if they want to see your conversation with Janice. Or Divorcing Religion, I guess that's another handle. I've seen the after party and some of that stuff on your YouTube channel. I'm really interested to talk to you because you're really focused on deconversion stories. And I want to get into why that is and what you've learned from talking to different people. You said you've had Jehovah's Witnesses, ex-Mormons, ex-fundamentalist Christian. So I'm really interested to find out about that. But what's your own story? I mean, were you born an atheist, obviously, or were you, did you convert, deconvert out of Christianity or some other religion? What's your backstory?
Well, for me, first and foremost, everyone's born an atheist until they're indoctrinated into some sort of a belief system.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I was born, interestingly enough, a little side note to the story is I was conceived in the back of a 57 Chevy, which is odd.
Classic.
Because my father that I grew up with after being adopted, he had a 57 Chevy that he was going to hold on to for his firstborn son to inherit after he was done with it.
And that was supposed to be you.
A little weird synchronicity sort of thing there. But anyways, I was born to a Christian couple whom I've met, by the way. I met them in the year 2000. And they were too young, and my birth father's mother was very staunch Catholic, so this whole having babies before marriage thing was a big no-no. So I ended up being put up for adoption and was brought home to my adoptive parents, which were Jewish, on Halloween Day. So basically, wow. I was raised in the Jewish faith, and I grew up, you know, going to Hebrew school and learning all the old biblical stories like David and Goliath. And I remember being young and thinking, wow, this is really neat stuff. But I also kind of remember thinking that it sounded mythological, like a lot of the other stuff that I'd read and heard about, like Greek mythology, Roman mythology. But I still thought, oh, well, I guess I'm still a believer because I didn't really know much else. Right. So I stuck with that up until about the time I had my bar mitzvah, you know, and I used to have conversations with God all the time, which to no avail, obviously. But once I started studying for my bar mitzvah, I got a little bit more in depth, and I started looking at other world religions and stuff too at the time, and just came to the conclusion, no, this stuff can't be real. There's just no possible way. Snakes don't talk. Donkeys don't talk. You're talking about books that start with a guy that speaks some incantation spell for everything to come into existence, and then at the end of it all, there's some seven-headed, ten-horned dragon, right? So I'm just like, there's no way this shit's real. It can't be real. So I decided maybe I'll investigate something else, and I got into the whole paganism thing in my late teens, early 20s, and was into that for a long time. I tried spells and stuff, and that didn't work. Like, one in particular kind of stood out to me was you need a ceramic bowl, and you put a silver dollar in it, and you catch the reflection of the full moon while it's underwater onto the top of the silver dollar, and you speak some bullshit, and then apparently you become wealthier, would bring money into your life. Well, that never happened, and I ended up having to sell my VCR. So, you know,
that's not good.
After time, I just was like, nah, I don't buy any of this shit. So I just became an atheist.
So, in terms of all supernaturalism, whether it's demonic or the God thing, you just sacked the whole thing off. So, when did you become an atheist? About what age were you around when this is all going down?
Well, I think I was an atheist, but I still, even in my mid-30s, I was kind of interested in, you know, afterlife stuff, because I still thought maybe it's possible. You hear the old thing, well, energy doesn't die, it just changes form, which I now know exactly how that happens. We end up becoming food for the fauna and flora that we fed off of, like Neil deGrasse Tyson said. Mike Tyson. Anyway, you know, and I now know that that's the case. But I wanted to be a ghost hunter at one time. I was going to run around with cameras and try and catch ghosts and stuff like that.
Was this after seeing Ghostbusters or what?
Probably, yeah. And I guess probably right around just before I kind of hit 40, I decided that stuff started to slide and wane too. And I would say I finally came fully and completely out of my beliefs like that probably about my mid-40s. So really... Or maybe even early. So really, it was quite late. But
quite late in the game.
I explored all possibilities, we'll say.
It seems like, I was just thinking about Penn Jillette. I don't know if you've seen that video that he did. It's on YouTube where he talks about how reading the Bible made him an atheist. It's quite funny in a way because, have you seen that? I think he was in high school, and his parents made him go to youth group every week. And every week he'd go home, read the Bible, and come back with more questions for the poor youth pastor, and he couldn't answer any of them, you know? And I think it was a similar kind of journey, what you've sort of described. It was actually, ironically, somehow reading the Bible and going, wait a minute. It's funny because when you hear those stories again, when you've stepped back away from it, some of them seem just really hard to believe that we ever believed that. Well, I don't know about you, but I came out of evangelical fundamental Christianity. I used to preach it. I used to teach it. And now I hear those same stories. I'm like, what the hell? Where's the morality here? You know, what? I don't know what the lesson is or what, but somehow it's got to apply. And in the Christian context, every piece of scripture, and I think this is where they run into trouble with some of those real problem passages. How does a passage talking about genocide, how does that apply to the Christian life today? They're going to struggle to figure out how to come up with an application. They got to defend God in that sense, and then somehow it applies. I don't know.
Yeah.
They have to twist themselves in knots, you know, as far as explaining these problem passages. I don't understand it myself, but I was drinking the Kool-Aid, man. I was, you know, I was in the whole thing. But why are you so interested in the deconversion side of it? You're saying you've talked to people who've come out of different faiths. Why did you start your YouTube channel, and what's that all about?
Well, once I started noticing these atheism YouTube channels, I would started, you know, as many of us do when we come out of the belief systems, we start just, you know, gorging on these things for more information on how people wrestle with their beliefs and how they free themselves from their beliefs. And I always found that sort of fascinating in its own right. So after seeing many, many people who I eventually got to know, like Godless Cranium, Godless Engineer, Caitlin, and many more, objectively, Dan, Anthony Magnabosco, Aaron Raw, stuff like that, I'm like, you know what? These guys are always saying you need to use your voice. So I thought I'm going to start my own channel, and I'm going to attack. I like talking to people, so I'm going to do something that allows me to do that, yet still hear how people freed themselves from their previous beliefs, and which I find fascinating, like I said. So I just thought it was the best medium for me, at least right now. Anyways, I do have plans for future ideas for the channel later, but just hearing these stories has always been kind of intriguing to me. And I think since I haven't seen too many deconversion story type channels, so to speak, I've seen people tell their stories on their channels, but I really only noticed maybe a small handful of these kinds of channels. And I thought, well, that's it. I want to do this. Maybe I can make a splash so that people will tune in, and people that are on the fence or having doubts or questions can hear these stories, and it might help them. Maybe someone can identify with some of these stories that I've been hearing and say, wow, okay, well, it was kind of tough for them to leave, but they eventually made it through, you know, because you hear all kinds of horror stories about family members excommunicating family members and friends dropping friendships, and which I never understand. I don't care what you believe. Your friends and your family should be the most important things in your life. But of course, as you know, they teach that God and Jesus or whoever, Muhammad, whoever, should be the most important, right? And, but which I've always said in the back of my head, well, yeah, well, demonstrate that the fucking things, these things even exist first.
Yeah,
and
for
then
a start,
tell me I should make them important.
And obey this deity and serve it, worship it, whatever. Now, have you found any common threads from religion to religion to religion? Because something that I've been discovering, talking to an ex-Scientologist on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he said that what he's finding is that when he talks to people that have come out of various religions, once you strip the ideology of that particular religion away, what you find is the psychological tactics that were used within that particular religion are universal. And this is what I'm finding is that in studying the way that cults work, I'm finding that both evangelicals, fundamentalist Jewish, Islamic, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Scientologists, they all use a similar sort of playbook. Is that what you found as far as the recovery side, as people are coming out, having to deal with all that, the psychological stuff?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are commonalities, but there are also a little bit different too, right? Because if you talk about Orthodox Judaism, which I just interviewed a fellow recently about that, Jews don't believe in hell, yet a lot of the other fundamentalist belief systems do have hell, and that lingers. I found the whole hell thing for many fundamentalists is one of the hardest things to let go. But there's guilt. There's you're not good enough without, you know, things that they put onto people, which is tough to break. I mean, when you've been, you know, told that you're you know, not so much worthless, but you're not worth as much without God in your corner.
Well, you're a
it's
sinner.
Really hard to free yourself.
Yeah, you're
from
a
that.
Sinner, especially the Christian theology. You're actually born a sinner. So as you said, you're born an atheist, but actually in Christian theology, no, you're already bound for hell before you've even started the first breath. You're on your way to hell, kid. And we grew up in church hearing that line. You know, you are a sinner bound for hell. You were born into sin because of something Adam and Eve did in the garden thousands and thousands of years ago. It's apparently nothing to do with me, but it's got everything to do with me. You talk about religious trauma. That's a big one. That's something that David Hayward and I talked about, a fellow Canadian of yours. But we talked about he deals with a lot of ex-evangelicals. Because both of us were both pastors in evangelicalism, and we have a lot of people that we both relate with on Twitter, Facebook, that come out of that scene. So that's what we know. And so I'm curious to find out what you found kind of in some of these other religions. How do they stack up in terms of this religious trauma? I mean, you're talking about hell. Have you found anything else as far as what people report to you?
Well, when I spoke to an ex-Muslim, he didn't have a problem showing his face on my show because I think he finally got past the part where with Islam, if you're an apostate and you've left the religion, there's a good chance if you live in a country where it's majority Islamic that you could be killed for leaving.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So that's another fear that people
it's a very
have
real
to
fear.
Deal with.
Yeah, it's not a phantom fear. It's absolutely the case. It's more than just being shunned. You're actually, your life could be in danger. It's a big step, massive step.
And that's to me. It's one of the most appalling things about these belief systems. And at one time, Christians, it was the same way. If you left Christianity, you could be killed. But that was, you know, before the reform of Christianity, obviously.
Have you gotten into the kind of the new atheism, the new wave atheists? Are you where do you fall in that? Because I had a guy named Hector Avalos. I don't know if you've come across him, but I know
the name.
Yeah, he's written a lot of books. The End of Biblical Studies, The Bad Jesus but he's very much into the scholarly end. I wouldn't recommend The Bad Jesus for someone who's just looking for a light read. I mean, he really gets into the details of it, but. Mm-hmm. He's one of these, what he called the new wave atheists, where what they're talking about is the dangers of religionism, which is kind of what you're describing, isn't it? They're saying, let's just step back and look at the dangers that religion has literally done to humanity for thousands and thousands of years. Strip away the ideology, look at the dangers of religionism. We need a world free from that kind of stuff. So that's where they're going from more of an academic point of view, but I don't know where do you align, because I know there's more than one type of atheist, isn't there? I'm not sure, because I'm not in that world necessarily. I haven't gone quite that far yet. I'm more of an agnostic, I think. I'm not sure what I believe yet, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah, for sure. There's many that are like you too. I'm definitely an atheist. I consider every deity ever thought up by man to be in mythology. So you got to think, man. There was times, you know, in the past where if you didn't follow along with the majority of the people were going, you were tortured or killed or whatever, burned at the stake or hung from a tree. Right?
And, Spanish Inquisition.
Even though that's not so much carried today, there are still some harsh penalties if you don't follow the pre-programmed doctrines that you are fed from youth, right? So,
well, as you said,
that's what indoctrination is. They get you while you're young and they teach you this way. And if you falter from it, you're either excommunicated or harsher things too. Even in Islam today, too.
Yeah, I was going to say
it's pretty harsh.
I mean, in some of the Taliban ruled areas of Afghanistan, you could be stoned if you're a woman for any sort of religious crime, can't you? And it's incredibly harsh if you're a man and you shave your beard. So if we were to shave our beards off, if we were, you know,
not going to happen.
Yeah, it's not going to happen for me, but I'm still growing it out as long as I can get it. But in some of those very fundamentalist Islamic countries, men have to have beards. If you go out in public without a beard, you're in danger of being stoned and publicly executed. And this is in the name of religion. Religious
Judaism has it too. That's why I see a lot of the ultra-religious Orthodox Jews with the beards and stuff like that.
Yeah, they don't cut
them. And they have the
ringlets.
Twirly thing, the payas, that's what they're called.
Yeah.
Actually, when I lived in Israel, it's still practiced like the ultra-religious Jews, which there's a branch called Hasidic.
Yeah, Hasidic. Very Orthodox.
When I was in Israel, in Jerusalem, and we walked through the area where they live, on the balconies you can see buckets, and in these buckets are stones. And if you walk by and you're smoking and it's, say, Shabbat,
they will
throw stones at you from their balconies. You can buy T-shirts at what they call the Shuk, which is the marketplace in Jerusalem, that say, I got stoned in Meshurim.
And it's not a, yeah, it's a thing. It's a real thing. Well, I don't smoke, so I might be on safe ground there, but man, that is unbelievable. Yeah. Well, I've seen that there's the clip in the Bill Maher movie, Religulous. I'm sure you've seen that movie, but
yeah,
you know, where he goes to Jerusalem, and this cracks me up as he's talking to that guy who's selling all these implements to help people get out of work, quote unquote, on the Sabbath, Shabbat. And it's so legalistic. I can have a machine that dials a phone number for me, so I'm not working on the Sabbath. It's just a wheelchair that's powered by compressed air, so I'm not working, but I need to travel from A to B. It's such a legalistic system. I can't get my head around some of that, but it seems to be human nature. You create a law, and then humans figure out a loophole around that law, so then you have to create another law just to close that loophole, and then they find another loophole, and on, and this is what Judaism sort of became, isn't it? It's got thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of laws to close loopholes.
Yeah.
It's a crazy system.
Yeah, I mean, if you're cooking Shabbat meal, the women have automated ovens that turn on at a specific time and last for a specific time. I mean, everything's automated for Shabbat. Another thing, like, we were in Jerusalem. I mean, the people, belief systems, but the people themselves are, you know, they're fun people, they're decent enough people outside of the belief system, because on Purim, which is sort of the Jewish version of Halloween, people dress up and get really, really drunk. So if you're walking through Jerusalem and there's a party going on and somebody sees you, they will literally run out there and grab you and pull you inside the building and stick a bottle of wine in your hand and say, come on, party with us. It's Purim, right?
I can get behind that.
Everyone just gets shit-faced. It's pretty funny, actually.
Yeah. The one time a year when you
that
can actually do it.
That was all like Steen, and they did that to me. and some friends.
And some friends. Well, I was watching a documentary. This is the thing, though, going back to this belief in God. Speaking of Jerusalem, I saw a documentary. It was on PBS called Jerusalem, God's Address. I don't know if you've seen this, but this is a fascinating documentary. What it is people from all over the world write letters to God, care of Jerusalem. And, I mean, they receive thousands and thousands of letters a day, and I don't know how many in a month. And it struck me that these are people from, I mean, all walks of faith, you know, Muslims, Christians, people who, you know, worship whatever. And they write, it just says, to God, care of Jerusalem. And it gets there to the post office. And there's all kinds of stuff. You know, God, I need help finding a job. God, I need help with my marriage. Whatever the request is. What do they do with all these letters? Well, a lot of them, they end up printing them off on a bigger piece of paper. And then they fold them up, and a guy goes out every so often and sticks them in a crack in the wailing wall. And then they're in there for a certain amount of time, and then they come tear them out, and they put it in the recycle bin. But it struck me that people are incurably religious. Why are they writing letters to God if there's no God? What is that about? What's that dynamic? Why are they so desperate for God to help them?
I think you just said it. They're desperate, so they'll try anything.
Literally.
I mean, I've stuck a couple of notes in the wall myself.
Right.
I've been there, so...
But you didn't get any response.
But I did it as a lark, basically. Right. I didn't really think anything was going to happen.
But why did
I just
you
wrote
use...
shit like, yeah, cheers, let's have another beer and stick it in the wall, right?
Well, you got your wine on Purim.
That's all I did, really.
So maybe that was an answer to prayer. Hey, you got your bottle of wine. See, God works in mysterious ways, man. You're going to become you're converted now. That did it.
Oh, yeah.
That did it.
Yeah, I tell you what. If a mug of unending beer popped in front of me right now, I'd be a believer.
Yeah, you'd be a believer. God has a vested interest in keeping you drunk. Well, it's what Martin Luther said, isn't it? It's something like beer is good because when people get drunk, they don't sin. And so let's keep drinking beer or something to that effect. So I know Martin Luther, he liked his good German beer. So he couldn't have been all bad, I guess. I don't know. But he launched the Reformation anyway. But what are people doing when they stick those notes in the wailing wall? Is that literally, it's like a prayer. Is that what they're doing? They're writing their prayer requests and sticking it in the crack. Why the wailing wall? Is that like a most holy place? Is that what it's about?
It's the last remaining wall from the Second Temple.
Right.
So, or so they say.
Yeah, Solomon's Temple. Or Herod's Temple. Yeah.
It's like making a wish.
Yeah.
That's me.
It's the same. It's the center letter to Santa Claus. That's what struck me about these letters to God.
Exactly.
If you put Santa Claus on the title instead of God, that's what you're describing. But now, going back to this atheist thing, it seems like some atheists are pointedly arguing against God. They've been. I don't know what you think about this, but it seems like there's different kinds of atheists, isn't there? Some who are they're on a rampage. They're going to disprove the existence of God. They're very militant. Do you see yourself in any sort of that spectrum? You're not actually like trying to deconvert theists, are you?
I'm not.
It's not your mission, as it were.
This is sort of a tough one because I'm not necessarily trying to deconvert people. What I'm doing is giving people stories and materials to use if they are having doubts. And if they end up deconverting because they've heard a couple of stories that ring true or ring familiar with them, and they start thinking a little bit more critically, then I think I've done a little bit of good.
Yeah.
And I think the less religious this world becomes, the better off we're going to be. Obviously, we're humans, and we'll find other ways to kill each other. That's just the way we are. We've been tribalistic since day one. So, but I'm just, to make the world just slightly, as much less religious as possible, I guess, is a goal. But that's one less avenue people are going to be able to use as an excuse to kill their fellow humans.
But I think your approach, it's very similar to mine in the sense, I don't feel like I'm actively seeking to deconvert people. I'm not an evangelist atheist, is as weird as that sounds. I'm like you. I'm interested to talk to people like yourself, hear your stories. And then what I found, the feedback I get from people that listen is they say, the part I like the most is hearing the stories, people's personal stories, because I can identify. It's very validating, I think, when someone hears someone else's story and goes, yeah, that's the same that happened to me, or very, very similar. I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. I'm not the only one who's going through this stuff. So I think it's a good approach. I don't know how, what's the feedback that you get? Is that kind of the similar things that you hear?
Absolutely. I hear a lot of people. I've had a few messages come through from people saying, I really appreciate what you're doing, because I've heard a few stories that ring very similar to mine. It's caused me to think about things a little differently once somebody else told me how they dealt with it, you know, through your stories. I've had a few people tell me that. So when you hear feedback like that, it's very, it makes me feel good, because at least I know that what I'm doing is helping at least somebody, right?
So
when you hear people tell you that, that's when it's okay. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, because you're not sure, right? When I first started doing these, I wasn't sure how people were going to take it. So.
Have you gotten any pushback from, like, Christians, Jews, Muslims, anyone who come after you? Have you gotten trolled anywhere?
Once or twice, but I ignore them.
Just blow it
off. People, oh, you should come out and debate me. I'll set you straight. And I'm like, dude, in my mind, there's no debate. So what would I be doing?
What are we debating? There seems to be this funny thing on Twitter, for sure, and I know on Facebook. I don't get as much on Facebook, but on Twitter, there's a lot of these really angry evangelical Christians who see it as their personal mission to, I guess, win us back into the fold, I guess. I think that's what they're doing.
Sure.
And they want to disprove everything, and they want to show us how we're wrong. And a couple guys have come after me and just started slinging Bible verses at me. And I'm like, whoa, 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 dude. First of all, I used to teach Bible. I've studied all that. I've studied the theology. I probably know it better than you. And second, I don't hold the Bible as my basic frame of reference anymore. I don't see it as an authority like you do and like I once did. So there's no point. What are you trying to prove by just throwing proof texts and proof texts and proof texts at me? It's not going to work. And that doesn't stop them, of course. Because they have this view of the Bible. It's inspired. It's inerrant. It's a holy book. Somehow it's got its own power, so that by just reading that verse, it will actually impact upon me, and I'll see the light, you know. And I think, man, this is magic. It's magical thinking. That's exactly what it is. Magical thinking.
Exactly.
Do you come across that in other religions? People that you talk to, that same sort of mentality?
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, if you think about it, every religion or religious belief style, even some of the ones like Buddhism, they all carry their weight of woo, is what I say, right? They all have their supernatural elements to it, which no matter how hard they try, they just can't seem to demonstrate in the natural world. So that's why you just push it aside. It's like, well, if you can't see, knowledge is always demonstrable. Anytime someone says, I know something, they can demonstrate how and why they know it. And if someone comes to you and says, well, I know that a God exists, I'm like, okay, well, then demonstrate it, because knowledge is demonstrable. And then they start, like you say, slinging all the – what's that?
Prove it. If it's really valid and objectively true, then it should be able to prove it somehow. How do they do it? Yeah. But then here comes all the proof texts then.
Yeah, that's right. And it's like, okay, this doesn't demonstrate anything. This just demonstrates that you seriously have fallen for this stuff and you believe it. That's all it demonstrates to me.
It's demonstrating their presuppositions. And that's the whole thing, isn't it? If you accept the rules of the game as they define it, then they've won in a sense, because you have to say, okay, I admit that your text, your sacred text, whether it's the Quran or the Torah or the whole Old New Testament, whatever text it is, if it's sacred, if it's got authority, then I have to submit myself to it, apparently. But if I step out of the rules of that game, sorry, it doesn't work, man. I don't buy the rules of your game. And yet that I see myself, that was the game I played for years and years and years. And I think, my God, I'm looking at it now. was I self-deluded? I mean, do you consider yourself, were you deluded when you were in Judaism? Or did you really ever fully believe it 100%?
I think when I was really, really young, I had convinced myself that I fully believed the stuff. But even at the age of like 10, 11, 12, when I started focusing in on studies for Bar Mitzvah, I started to part ways with that sort of thought. And definitely after reading other religious books and seeing the similarities, that kind of thing, and then learning about the stories that the biblical stories pilfered from.
Right. Yeah.
One example being the Noah and the Epic of Gilgamesh. That just solidified it for me in my late teens, for sure. I was just like, there's no, I mean, and there are other stories that have been pilfered from other, even older stories, right? So,
yeah, many civilizations have those stories, don't they? Ancient Near Eastern civilizations. Mm-hmm. They have flood narratives and creation myths and all that. And yet, no, the Bible was completely inspired. It's 100% true. It's unique. And this is basically what Hector Avalos does in his book, The Bad Jesus. He says, what you Christian evangelical scholars are doing, you've elevated Jesus and put him up on a pedestal, and you said everything Jesus said was completely original, completely unique. Nobody else ever said anything like what Jesus said. And he goes back and shows, no, there were many, many people who said things way before, hundreds of years before Jesus ever existed, in class in Greece and Rome and other places. What about that? No answer.
Right.
No answer. You know. Well, he's unique.
They don't know how to answer it.
Yeah, but they're not doing their homework. That's just basically what Hector Avalos is saying. Guys, you're not studying antiquity here. Look at ancient Near Eastern texts. You look at philosophers and things. They were saying love your enemies and things like that way hundreds of years before Jesus was ever born. So how is he that unique? Who knows? It's been exalted to this, well, divine, literally a divine status, isn't it? And that's what I think is once you put it up there on that pedestal and say, we can sell you salvation in our system, now we've got you. You know, we're selling it. You have to buy it from us, and then you're trapped in that system. I don't know what your take on it is, but that's kind of the way I'm seeing it now. That this is where the psychological coercion comes in, because once you convince someone, hey, you're going to hell, and then I got to get out of this thing. What do I need to do? Well, let me tell you all about it. You know, and that's a universal thing in many religions, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, they'll come to me with. I've had JWs show up at my door. I've had Mormons show up, and you know, just like you said, we have the salvation that we want to sell you from this situation. I go, well, dude, you know what? I don't believe the situation, so I don't need your salvation.
Exactly. So. You're not playing the rules of that game. They're so fervent about it and so indoctrinated in their cults. This is something I've talked to now ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. I've got a couple of ex-Mormons coming up. It's going to be a very interesting thing. So I guess I'm kind of like you. I'm going down that line and seeing how the stories are similar and yet different. As you say, each one's got a little bit different twists to it. What are some of those differences that you've found? Have you found anything that's really significantly different in the different religions you've talked to, the different people that have come out?
With the religion part of it, I think they're all really similar.
Right.
I think it's just the day-to-day things of each of the people that I've spoke to, like just their lifestyles are really, truly the only real differences, I would say, because I found that most of these stories go one of sort of two ways, like either everything after they've deconverted turns out it's okay, the family gets it, or they tolerate it, or whatever, and nothing much changes except that now this family member of ours is now an atheist and the rest of us are still religious. Or I find that they go down some traumatic, where the family disowns them, they're literally I've even had one guy that kind of was sort of ushered out of the little town that he lived in, because they didn't want to accept him there anymore.
Wow, literally kicked out of town.
You know, so it's either an amicable split. It's like a divorce almost. You either have an amicable split or an extremely bad one. And although there have been middle-ish ground where, you know, you only lost a couple of friends as opposed to all of them or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But for the most part, I think the only differences are who they were outside of that, really. But the religious part and the separation from it, it carries quite common themes, at least as far as I found.
Well, that's a good analogy. I think that's why Janice has that Twitter tag, Divorce Religion, because like a divorce, there's a lot of emotional fallout, isn't it, that comes along with that. When you've been with somebody for 10, 20, 30 years, and then you split in a literal marriage that's divorce, ends in divorce, it's you don't just shake hands and walk away. I mean, You've committed decades of your life to this person. You might have children. You've invested so much time, and you've got to deal with all that stuff and go through all the trauma and all the hurt and all the, you know, the grief of loss and everything. And then, as you say, there's a social cost. You know, you've got people who disown you. In some extreme cases, shunning, or even in the case of, like you say, your extreme Islamic context, you could be in danger of being killed. So, yeah, there's definite differences, isn't it? That's an interesting perspective.
For sure.
What have you found in terms of your own mental health? I guess that's a way to ask it. Since you've walked away from all that, do you feel like your life is different in any way, better? So how have things changed, really, since you said, okay, I'm an atheist now?
I think the biggest things that I've noticed is, A, I don't fear death anymore. As long as it's not painful, I'm pretty okay with it.
Yeah, that would work.
I found I have an interest in why people believe what they believe now. As I didn't so much before, but once I got out of these belief systems, it sort of now has kind of tagged along with me. It's kind of, okay, so I got out of this. I know why I believed what I believed. I am now interested in finding out why others either still believe what they believe or why they once believed what they believed, because I've had conversations like that with people too. So, yeah, I think that pretty much it. Other than that, I find there's nothing looming, it just seems. Like, you know, when you were a believer, there was always something that was just like a shadow over you that was looming, and that's gone completely. So, like, I'm not afraid that someone's watching me while I masturbate anymore, you know, that kind of thing, right?
The surveilling God.
You know, just like those little ridiculous things that you carried with you as a believer of whatever ilk are gone, all of them.
It's so true, isn't it, that this surveilling God kind of image in Christianity, it's a very powerful one because, it's like God's always watching us. In a way, I mean, I've heard this analogy, you know, when you die, you're going to go stand at the pearly gates, and then here comes a screen and all these, basically a movie of your life is going to be replayed every minute you ever lived, everything you ever did, good, bad, ugly, whatever, every thought you ever had, because God, of course, knows all that, and he's recording it somehow. And, you know, everyone's going to be watching all the shameful things we ever did on the big screen.
It's funny.
Yeah,
it's funny, you know, as technology advanced, you kind of wonder, well, did they start out with like somebody hammering shit onto a rock, and then VHS came along, and then now they've got DVDs up there. Like, how does it work up there? Did they advance too in technology, or do they have the ultimate?
Oh, heaven's way ahead.
We have yet to reach.
It's funny because I don't know if you ever come across. There's a guy. His name was Jack Chick, and he used to write these little tracks, the Chick tracks.
Chick tracks.
I grew up because my mom actually worked in a Christian bookstore and they sold Chick tracks in the bookstore. So I used to go in there when I was
sold them.
Yeah, they actually sold them. They were in the bookstore in a rack. This is going back probably.
They're supposed to be free.
Oh yeah. Well, maybe they gave them away. I don't know. I was always under the impression they sold them, but there was a rack of these things in the Christian bookstore in Seattle. And I used to go in there when I was waiting for my mom to get off work. I'd leaf through these Chick tracks. And I can remember one where it said, you know, God is recording everything you ever do. And there's this picture of these angels. And they've got video cameras. You know, even as a kid, I remember thinking, now, wait a minute. 100 years ago, that doesn't work. Because there was no such thing. As you say. They're just. So how does that work then? What were they doing 1,000 years ago? They didn't have video cameras. It's a modern twist on it. And then all that's going to be replayed, you know, when we get to heaven. Apparently so. So, yeah, good old Jack.
Yeah, how's that going to work?
Fundamentalist. But he talked about fear-mongering. You know, every tract is all about how so-and-so died and they're in the flames of hell. And, I mean, it's fundamentalism at its finest, really. Sort of the Westboro Baptist Church sort of theology. You know, they're going to picket funerals.
In a comic.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's like a comical version. But yet it obviously works, I should say, because people are listening. They're believing it. They're drinking the Kool-Aid, as it were. Well, now, I'm interested to find out how can people get a hold of you, too, because you've got a YouTube channel. Are you doing anything else besides the channel? You said you have other plans sort of in the works. Is it okay to talk to you about where you think you're going to be going as far as down the road?
I'm
going
to do probably another series. I'm not sure how many of them I'll do, like chats and stuff like that. But I'm going to be doing a series on altruism in atheism. Like, because we often hear that it's impossible for somebody to have morals without a God. And I want to do a series that sort of has that theme to it, where I want to talk to other atheists that have started charities or have started blood drives like myself and other things like that, just to show that, guess what? We may be godless, but we still give a crap about our fellow human beings, and we do the things that we do to better the world just a little bit as much as we can. We're only, you know, single people doing this, so we can only make as much of an impact as we can, but the more of us that do it, then the better off it'll be.
You know,
I thought of a series like that.
You're doing that, yeah.
And then I thought of possibly just talking about epistemology, like what we used to believe, why we believed it, like have little chit-chats about that sort of thing too. And I've already got some people that are interested in doing that with me. And my friend Randolph Richardson and myself are starting our own version of a call-in show like Atheist Experience and Talk Heathen and Truth Wanted right up here in Canada. We're going to start doing that probably this coming summer. We've got some stuff already in the works. We're just looking for a location, and we've already got all the equipment that we're going to need. So we're going to be doing our own call, the first in Canada, by the way.
Wow.
Our own call-in show.
There's got to be a Canadian atheist out there somewhere.
You're
the only Canadian atheist. How many people are in Canada? You know, you're the only two. I think you'll find there must be a few more.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Randolph is the founder of Canadian Atheists.
Yeah.
So we're both members. They're going to be sponsoring the show and stuff like that, too. So we'll see what happens.
I was going to ask you about that, too, because that is, as you say, that's a common tag that's slapped on atheists. You're a godless pagan. You don't have any morals. There's no moral compass without a God. But, yeah, of course, we find out that in my world, coming out of evangelicalism, Christians can be such complete assholes, you know. And I think, wait a minute, where's that loving God that you purport to serve? Why are you treating people so horribly? And then when you do good things, it's with a string attached. I'm either doing it to build a relationship with you to preach the gospel, or I am doing it to somehow earn brownie points for rewards in heaven. Whereas you have none of those sort of strings, do you?
No, not at all. And I find it kind of funny. I can't tell you how many times I've had these, not so much debates, but talks with theists that literally say, you know, without a God, I'd probably just run around killing people. And, well, great. I wouldn't want to live in your fucking neighborhood.
Yeah. What are you, a serial killer? What's holding you back? God's holding you back.
I think they're
going on a rampage.
Yeah, fucking assholes. That's all they are.
But how does that work in terms of morality? Okay, what's your answer to that evangelical that says, okay, Neil, you probably should be a serial killer about now. You, where's the bodies piled up, man? You know, we got to start digging in your backyard. What stops you?
I'm not telling you.
What stops you from going on that rampage? You know, you don't have any moral compass. What's your answer to that? Do you need one?
That one's actually quite easy.
Okay, what do you say?
Well, I used to think that. But what I tell them, I says, well, you know what? I don't want to be killed, at least not yet, not until I'm done doing what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
So why would I kill somebody else?
Yeah, it's kind of golden
rule. It's really that simple.
Yeah, yeah. Why does it have? Why make it more complicated? If that's the world you want to live in, then you can help create that world, hopefully, whatever that looks like, by being a decent human being. What sense of morals, you know, do you have to have? You have to have God to hold you back? I don't understand how that works.
And yeah, these, I don't either.
I don't either.
I have to share this planet with tons of other human beings, so I'm going to be the best possible version of myself and encourage others to be the best possible version of themselves, and in that way, we can make this place better. That's the way I look at it.
It's a simple philosophy. Well, and these are all the things that the church, at least in my, again, coming from my background, that was all the stuff the church said they were going to do for us. Be the best person you can be. Be the person God made you to be. What I found is that in the church, in evangelicalism, your identity had to be suppressed, that you had to put the mask on. You actually couldn't be yourself because it was too risky if you opened up and said, this is really who I am and this is where I'm at. Oh, no, no, no. You can't talk like that. You've got to learn to become an actor. And so to me, it's the supreme irony that all the things that we were supposed to get out of Christianity for sure, they never delivered. And in fact, they handed us all kinds of traumas and bullshit that we have to deal with now.
That's the guilt.
I mean, the guilt, the shame, and all the rest of it, the surveilling God. I mean, where's the joy? Where's the peace in that? Where God's always watching you, man. These angels are walking around with video cameras recording us all the time. You know, and that's what you were saying. The dangers of religion itself. Look what it does to people.
Sure.
It's a mind fuck. That's what David Hayward said. The whole thing's
absolutely
a mind fuck. And now we've got to recover from all that. So it's the supreme irony.
Yep.
I'm glad there's people like you out there that are doing what you're doing. You know, that's for sure, man.
Back at you, man, because I think what you and I do helps people quite a bit.
It really
and
does.
And often, I mean, if you're feeling trauma from believing your religion, I often refer people to Recovering from Religion, the organization, because they can help a lot.
It is such a supremely ironic thing. Why do we have to recover from religion? This thing that's supposed to set people free and empower people and make people better, it does the exact opposite. And so now we've got to deconstruct. Yeah, it can. That's a good question. Are there healthy religions? Would you say, was there anything that you would say, I have no problem with that. It's a healthy organization. Have you come across anything like that you'd actually direct somebody to?
If somebody really wants to hold on to some sort of a religiously spiritual existence, I refer them to, even though there's still woo attached, I refer them to stuff like Buddhism or Jainism,
right,
something like that. Yeah. I mean, I also like the Native American, South American belief systems too, where they're very attached to nature. Right. So
yeah. Well,
and the mythologies are fucking awesome.
Yeah.
They're really, really cool stories.
Well, as a philosophy of life, I think that might be a big difference, isn't it? You're not saying, I'm going to follow this religion to earn my way to heaven or some celestial reward.
Yeah.
I'm just going to follow it as a life philosophy. This is something my sister Valerie has found. She does this meditation podcast every morning, and it's very helpful for her just to center her. It's all about sort of, you know, meditation. She's not praying to any deity. She's not doing any of that. It's just helping her to be calm and to find her center, as it were, every morning. And it's been hugely life-changing. And she's saying, look, it's not my religion. It's just a philosophy of life. It's helping me. What's wrong with that? To be a better person, mentally. What's wrong with that?
It's a natural philosophy.
Yeah. So,
there's no supernatural involved.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a calming, centering sort of thing. Well, and the anxiety, the social anxiety that she had was from her time in religion. So that's helping
her.
That's
not surprising.
Yeah. So it's helping. And she said, because she's come over here every other year. She's come. And we're both huge World War I buffs. That's my kind of area of interest. And so because we live here in the UK, we go down to – I go every year to various different parts of World War I battlefields and places like that. In fact, as a Canadian,
cool.
You'd be – you know, we went to Passchendaele last year. I don't know how much you're into the history of it, but these are all very important places to Canadians, aren't they? Langemark and places like that. We went there last year. But she was saying that – talking to strangers, she could never do that before, which I love talking to strangers. I'll talk to anybody anywhere. I think you're probably the same way. I'll sit down, I'll have a beer, and I'll have a beer in a pub, and the next thing I know, I'm chatting away with the guy sitting next to me, and we're having an amazing conversation about something, you know. But she's noticed that her crippling social anxiety has just kind of gone away because of this meditation. So it's been hugely helpful, man. Well, now I'm.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, I don't want to keep you too long. How can people get a hold of you besides your YouTube channel? What's your Twitter handle? What's the best way? Is that the best way for people to kind of get in touch with you?
Yeah, I'd say, sub to my channel if you are interested in these kinds of stories.
Yeah.
I am available on Twitter. I have my DMs open. So it's at 604atheist. You can find me there, and you'll find me as Neil, the 604atheist. You'll find me on Facebook. Just Neil Bernstein. I'm pretty hard to miss, so you'll look at the picture and go, oh, that's him.
That's the guy with
I'm like you. I got the hair.
The hair, the mustache, and the beard, and all that. Yeah. Epic.
Oh, yeah.
It's an epic mustache and beard. I was going to give a shout-out to one of my listeners, one of your subscribers, Alistair McCallum. Mm-hmm. He's one of our Patreon supporters from Scotland. He always comments on your after parties and things, so I've been posting up in our Facebook group that I was going to be talking to you, and he's like, oh, yes. I love Neil the Atheist. I subscribe to his channel. He gets in on the after parties. So big shout out to Alistair from Scotland. And so, yeah, it's a funny small world. How small is it?
I know who you're talking about too. He's awesome.
Yeah, in fact, he's like us in the sense that where we met on Facebook, you know, we were both into rock and roll, heavy metal, the whole thing. That's my scene. I played in bands for years and years, you know, so we agree on our musical styles.
I need a bass player.
I'm a drummer. We need a bass player.
Isn't that always seem to be it?
I know. Why is it that way? Bass players are the hardest ones to find. Yeah. We've got a band that we...
Because all the good ones.
That's the good ones, yeah. Well, we had a band in North Wales for about 5 years. We played, like, seriously heavy, heavy rock and metal covers. We were a cover band.
Cool.
But I loved it, man. That was part of my reconstruction as well, because way back in the 80s, I played in Christian metal bands. That was my scene. You know, we were going to evangelize the world through heavy Christian metal, like Stryper and all those guys, you know. But I didn't quit playing drums, but I kind of walked away from all that. But then I picked it up about 10 years ago over here, and I thought to myself, why wasn't I back into this? This is the music I've always loved. I love playing it. This is who I am. So that was a huge thing for me. I mean, I don't know about you, but are you a guitar player? Is that what you play?
Music has been my life for years.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm the vocalist.
Oh, right.
So I'm the singer in our band. Actually, if anyone is interested in hearing what we have to offer, we've got about a dozen or so songs on SoundCloud.
What's the name of the band?
The band is Liminis. It's Liminis. We were called Threshold at one time, but there's already a band Threshold, and they threatened to sue us.
Oh,
so
that's not good.
I thought, okay, I was into ancient languages at the time, so I looked up what Threshold might be in Latin.
Latin,
and I couldn't find anything that sounded cool enough. But on the threshold is what Liminis means.
You're still in the ballpark. It's funny, isn't it? Trying to pick a band name, that's the hardest thing. Our band was called Black Sunrise, and we thought this was a cool name. But then we found out, of course, there's 100 other bands called Black Sunrise.
Yeah, it's hard.
But not here in the UK. There's one out of Denmark or something like that. We thought, I think we're safe. You know, we didn't, nobody threatened to sue us or whatever. Plus, we were just playing covers, so we weren't, you know, infringing on anyone's territory. But... yeah, now I only play a couple times a year, which is really a bummer because I wish we played more. But, you know, like most bands, we ended up breaking up and doing the whole big band fight and all that, you know. And I'm sure you've been through that many a time if you've been around music.
It was never anything hostile, just members came and went.
That's
and
what it still, is, yeah.
There's only two members in my band right now that are the original crew. My lead guitarist passed away last year.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was a hard one to swallow. But he hadn't been playing with us for a while because he moved over to Vancouver Island. So we had restarted with a newer bass player that we had who ended up going on guitar. And my old guitar player's nephew ended up coming to play bass for us for a while. But he's in and out of the province too much to last. So, yeah, we're once again looking for a new bass player.
Well, I'll tell you what. How about this? Let me throw something at you. I'm coming to Seattle for 3 weeks in July, right? So at some point, I could either come up to BC or a caravan come down. I've got a drum kit there, but I've also got a cajon. Okay, I left it there when I was there last time. Now, my friend Big Steve, he's the guy that recorded our podcast. We did a bunch of gigs together in the Seattle area. We did open mic nights and things, and he does acoustic stuff. And I was just on the cajon backing him up. So we're going to be doing some more of that. So maybe that we might be collaborating at some point. You never know.
That'd be fun.
That would be fun, man. So hopefully I will see you in July. Either I come up to BC and I'll, you know, meet Janice and some of the other people up there. Or maybe we can figure out, because I want to do a live podcast in Seattle. So maybe there's something. We never know. But I'll keep in touch and we can figure something out. Cool, man. Well, listen, I've really appreciated it. I've absolutely loved meeting you. Thanks again to Alistair for connecting us up, man. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been fun, man. I've enjoyed the chat.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I will definitely be speaking to you again. Maybe I'll see you in July. No, there's no maybe about it. We got to do it. We got to hoist a pint.
Well,
got to play some music.
Yeah, oh, fuck yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's not even a question. Okay, we'll do that for sure. All right, cool, man. Thank you so much, Neil. I will see you in July. I'm not even going to say maybe. It's going to happen somehow. It's going to happen, man. All right, cool.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that chat with Neil 604. I definitely did. I enjoyed meeting Neil because, first of all, as I said in the end, we're going to be getting together. When I go to Seattle, I'm going to be there for about the first 3 weeks of July doing some work for some friends. And one of the weekends, I think the 12th, 13th, 14th, right around there, we're going to be making a trip up to BC. Me and my sister Valerie, actually, she was on the podcast a few times, so she wants to go up and meet Neil as well. So we're going to make a road trip up to Canada. We're going to meet with some people. In fact, I'm going to be meeting Jana Selby in person for the first time. So I'm super excited about that, getting to meet people that are part of this podcast. Stacey Ray, I think, is going to be there as well. Some other people from Canada are going to come around. And if you're in Seattle, by the way, in that time when I'm in Seattle, we're going to be doing another ex-evangelical gathering, a get-together. We're probably going to go out to dinner. We're going to have a good time. Every time I've been to Seattle, we've done that. We've had a great gathering of, you know, 5, 10, 15 different people that have come out, getting to know each other, have a few drinks, have a few laughs, but telling each other's stories. It's a good supportive community. So look for some notifications coming up as we get closer to July. If you're in the Pacific Northwest area, you can either come up to Canada, make a road trip, and be a part of our live thing on the 13th, or we can meet up in Seattle when we do some sort of get together. So that'll be really cool. All right, so don't forget, coming up in 2 weeks is my conversation with Ronna Russell. If you want to check out her book, you can go to ronnarussell.com. The Uncomfortable Confessions of a Preacher's Kid. Get a little bit of a preview about her story. You can buy that book on Amazon. You can also buy it through my Amazon affiliates page. If you want to help support the podcast, you can go to my website, preachersforum.com. You'll see a link for the Amazon affiliates page, and I'll put her book. If you buy it through that, you'll get it at the regular Amazon price, but I get a little bit of a cut and help support the show. So that's another way you can do it, and also support people like Ronna as well. Now, if you've been following the show at all since January, you know that I've been doing a lot of things on the world of the cults. And in fact, this is something that Ron and I do get into, in particular the psychological damage that is done to people by both evangelical as well as mainstream churches, religion, cults, all those kind of things. We're going to be keeping it in that world as we talk about her own experiences and her own reconstruction. And in fact, while I'm thinking of it right now, I'm just going to mention that I put a video up on Patreon, another one of my Reconstruction After Deconstruction courses, which is available for supporters of this show. And also, there's another bonus episode sitting on there right now, which is about how cults maintain control, how it is that cults operate, how leaders function to control and manipulate their followers. So these are helpful resources. And again, these are great rewards for people who support the show on Patreon. Now, I've got a couple things in the works as well. I missed, unfortunately, the window of opportunity to talk to the guys from the How To Heretic podcast because they're both ex-Mormons, so that's a really interesting one. So I'm looking to get those guys back on the show at some point. One of them had to do a business trip, so he's unavailable right now. So that's going to be coming up, as well as I'm still working on getting cult expert Stephen Hassan on the show. He's been working on a project, so unfortunately, he's had to push back our scheduled recordings a couple times. So I'm still working on that. I've got some other things in the works, so stay tuned for some really good content. You can also check out some articles that I've been writing on medium.com. There's some stuff. I wrote an article called Is Evangelicalism a Cult? And that's an interesting one that kind of unpacks a lot of the things that I've been learning about, again, the psychological and other sorts of damage that evangelicalism does to people and how to recover from that, how to unpick the conditioning, which is hugely important to do if you're going to recover. So look at that on Medium as well. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. All right, so I'm going to let you go. Thanks for tuning in to this conversation with myself and Neil 604. I'll catch you in a couple of weeks with Ronna Russell as we talk about the Uncomfortable Confessions of a Preacher's Kid right here on Mindshift Podcast.